The Evolve Network is now live at evolvenetwork.tv. Subscribe for meal plans, recipes, cooking shows, and our very own The Magic Pill and The Magic Plant, as well as access to my favourite documentaries. The Evolve Network is also home to our full library of podcasts, with new release podcasts airing first and in full on the channel. You can also watch selected vodcasts in a video format. Enjoy this highlight of our podcast and head over to evolvenetwork.tv for the full Evolve podcast experience. The Evolve with Pete Evans podcast is a conversation about my favourite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. I love exploring the topics that are not traditionally taught at school and take a deep dive into them with my special guests. I invite you to sit back and come along for the ride with an open mind and heart, and please share with your family and friends, as these podcasts may just be the seed from which many things will flourish from. Cheers. We've been using Waters Co. water filters for the last 10 years, and I wholeheartedly trust my family's health with them. Waters Co., established 1977, have personal and domestic water filters, which turns your ordinary tap water into great-tasting, alkaline, ionized mineral water, which removes up to 99.9% of fluoride, heavy metals, chemicals, and bacteria, so you can love your tap water again. The Bio 1000 is the latest edition of the BMP 1000 model and the culmination of over 40 years of experience and research into water filtration by some of the world's leading scientists. Waters Co. was first to market with natural gravity-fed systems, creating alkaline water way back in 1984, and have continued to lead the market in research and development, setting the benchmark for all other brands to follow. Please go to my webpage, PeteEvans.com, to learn more and to receive your special discount from my link on the products page. You're going to love it. Dr. Andy Kaufman is a natural healing consultant, inventor, public speaker, forensic psychiatrist, and expert witness. He completed his psychiatric training at Duke University Medical Center after graduating from the Medical University of South Carolina and has a BS from MIT in molecular biology. He has conducted and published original research and lectured, supervised, and mentored medical students, residents, and fellows in all psychiatric specialties. He's been qualified as an expert witness in local, state, and federal courts, and he has held leadership positions in academic medicine and professional organizations. He ran a startup company to develop a medical device he invented and patented. To find out more about Dr. Andrew Kaufman, or Andy, please visit andrewkaufmanmd.com. That's andrewkaufmanmd.com. Andy, thank you so much for joining us. How are you, brother?
I'm doing great. It's nice to be here.
We were just having a laugh that I never prepare anything, and it's quite early in the morning. It's 6 a.m. here, and fascinatingly enough, this is my most creative time of the day. Like between 5 a.m. and 9 a.m., it seems to be the time that my brain seems to be in the best state to be able to create and express myself. And I wanted to start possibly with that, because I've never really spoken about anybody like that, but why is it that certain individuals or certain people seem to have these different times where, or different ideas about themselves when they're at their most creative? Is that anything that you could comment on?
Yeah, well, certainly I could. And, you know, I have my times as well. And I think that the morning is actually quite a good and productive time in general, because, you know, what your body does while you're sleeping to restore yourself. So, you know, there's a couple of big functions that go on during your sleep. And one is that you're dreaming, and during your dreaming, you're processing things from the day, you're consolidating learning, and perhaps exploring some deeper things that are a little beyond my ability to describe. But then there's also all of the cleanup, like detox and renewal functions that your body does. So, you know, your body shuts down digestion at night, and it basically goes around and starts to detoxify tissues and see where repairs need to be made. And that's a really critical part of sleep, and why people who are deprived of sleep chronically have so many other health problems, because they're not doing that properly. So there's those aspects, that your body's at a very refreshed state from that sleep process. And if you are early to bed, supposedly the hours of sleep before midnight, there are more of those processes going on. So that's one aspect. But the other thing I think has to do with just biological cycles, which is a concept that I think plays very strongly into our health and is part of nature. If we observe any aspect of nature around us, we see various cycles going on. And like right now in the United States, we're coming into the fall and you're coming into the spring, right? So we see major changes in the plant life and the animal life those times of year, right? And it's a predictable pattern that occurs in cycles. And all of our biological systems at multiple different levels have different ways of having cycles. So we have like our sleep, wake, day, night cycle, right? And throughout the day, we might experience different things. Like it's very common for people to get tired in the middle of the afternoon, for example, to have a creative boost or a boost of energy in the morning. There are a lot of people that like to work out in the morning. And then we have, you know, within that, lots of other cycles that we go through. And there's even like biological chronometers that have been described in various organs systems. And obviously, like our heart goes through cycles, right? It goes through a cycle with every beat. So this is a pattern that repeats. So we may have that kind of thing. Like for me, the most creative time, I would say, like I'm very productive in the morning, but it's in the shower. Something about being in the shower with the water coming down, being isolated from everyone else, I always have some of my best creative inspirations with that experience. And it's pretty much always in the morning. So very similar to you, I think we have compatible types of patterns.
Love that. Thank you so much. You mentioned something there, which you've seemed to, your eyes lit up when you were talking about nature. Let's I mean, you are a psychiatrist as one of the hats that you wear, or one of the masks that you wear, or one of the skills that you've learned. How does nature fit into psychiatry? Or does it?
Wow. That's a really interesting question. And no, I think it does in many ways. Like one thing that I think is a major contributor to some of the psychic or psychological distress that we experience as a culture has to do with the urbanization, you know, of our people. And going into the city, or, you know, as I sometimes refer to, the concrete jungle, you really are not interacting, like you're not grounding with your feet, right, to the earth. You're only stepping on artificial man-made materials all the time, and everything surrounding you is steel and glass, and they have a very different feel than being, you know, in the forest or the pasture. And so I think that a lot of the way people behave in cities, now some of it has to do with limited resources and so many people that it's, you know, beyond a normal community that you can keep track of. But I really think that being around an artificial environment all the time has a real detrimental effect on the psyche. But, and I know also that being in nature, and even traditionally, like even if we go back to the time where, you know, people would send or their family members or would go off to like a sanatorium to sort of recover from some period of being depressed or anxious, right? And even wealthy people would do this. And these types of facilities were always located in a natural pastoral setting. Right? It's like almost as if we all know that nature helps us heal emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, and physically. And so that if we immerse ourselves in a natural setting, like many clients come to me, for example, with a variety of health-related issues, and some of them are emotional and some of them are physical, but often there is a psycho-spiritual component that is a predominant part of their struggle. And one of the things that I tell them about that could be helpful in that is to have a contemplation time in a natural setting. So basically sit in nature, you know, every day for a period of time, like I would say a minimum of around 20 minutes, and just let yourself be without any artificial stimulation, like, you know, no cell phones, no other people around, no music, just the sounds and sights and feel of nature. And that experience, it opens us up and it allows for insight and inspiration and enlightenment, I think. So people can get a feel for, you know, what should I do to make my life better or make myself better? How can I, you know, be more natural in a way, right? Like there's so much harmony that we see in nature. So how can we bring that harmony into our life? I mean, I don't want to say, you know, there's struggle in nature too, right? There's earthquakes are natural and things like that, but those are transformative, you know, violent events in nature that bring about a new birth. And so we can look at that, make that analogy to our life as well, that if we go through a very difficult experience, and we all do, that that can be a transformative experience, and we can use that to make ourselves much better on the other end, and just like in nature.
Mm, beautifully said, mate. I love that. My family and some friends actually had a great gift yesterday. We went swimming with humpback whales just off the coast here in Australia. And
wow, that does sound incredible.
Wow. I
mean, they're so big.
We were miles out from the coast, and these beautiful, huge creatures just playing. And they enter into the water as such a small little human being and into that deep blue ocean. I mean, the whales were one thing, but the enormity and of the ocean was actually nearly more profound for me, to be able to just be on top of that ocean looking down and knowing that it was so deep out there, and within 10 meters or say 30 feet, you couldn't see anything. And just that unknowing sort of gave me it brought up fear, but it also brought up a curiosity and wonder. And it was so hard to describe how many different emotions and beliefs were running through me at that particular point in time. It was nearly overwhelming, but at the same time, just I was definitely embodied in my in my being. So I have to agree, being in nature and nearly challenging yourself sometimes can be so rewarding.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, there's so much you could glean from that experience. And I've had similar experience, and it is like to the point that it can be almost overwhelming. But what part of it was, right, is that you were really unable to perceive. It's not your natural medium to be in, right? Because if you're, let's say you're at the bottom of a canyon, you're also surrounded by vast space and you can't see all of it, right? There are animals in the trees and such, but you feel totally different there, right? Because it's your natural and you take these things for granted. But when you're in this foreign kind of world, right, the vast ocean, and you don't really know what's around you, you don't know what to expect, everything is new. It's really like that for us all the time, because what we can perceive is only a tiny, 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 tiny fraction of the information that's around us all the time. Like, for example, just take our vision. What we can see in terms of visible light makes up, you know, way, way less than 1% of all of the electromagnetic waves that are out there, right? That we can't perceive them. And like we've seen, for example, with an infrared camera, right? We've all seen images like that, you know, for night vision. And that's always there. It's there at night. We just can't see it with our eyes. And besides that, there's millions of other different kinds of signals that we can't perceive, right? So really, we're always in this unknown space that we only know about a tiny, tiny portion of it. The rest, you know, it's up to your imagination almost. But even realizing it's there suddenly, you know, that you could be surrounded even by other types of creatures that you can't perceive, and maybe they can't perceive you either, right? That's an overwhelming thought if you let it go to its logical conclusion.
You mentioned something before, which when you said it really hit home for me, because I've never been that comfortable in cities or in crowds. I generally shy away from any interaction where I have to be immersed, so to speak, in that city experience where there's thousands or tens of thousands of people in an area, and going to a concert in a stadium. It's like the last thing that I ever want to do, no matter who the band is playing, because being in that situation, I find it super uncomfortable, like really uncomfortable. And you mentioned something before, like talking about how humans interact can become overwhelming because we've evolved to be connected beings, but in that space, it just becomes so overwhelming. And I guess when you see people walking through the city, and I'll never forget something my father told me 20 years ago. He goes, when he walks through the city, he goes, try to find somebody that's smiling.
when they're walking.
And I've always considered that. I was like, what is that about? And I think you might have hit the nail on the head there. Talk to me a little bit deeper about this, because I think there could be something quite huge in this.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I grew up mostly in the city, in New York City, in one of the outer boroughs. And one of the things that's always struck me, and I've seen this happen so many times, and I've been guilty of this as well, is that you have a crowded city scene, like let's say outside of a subway station, right, where there's lots of foot traffic, and there'd be, you know, someone lying there on the ground looking, you know, ill health, right? There's something wrong. There's some medical issue or whatever. Maybe they're even dying. And people just, you know, walk by continuously without giving notice, even really just like tunnel vision. And this is something like you'd never see in a rural area, because either that person would be someone they know and grew up with and they would come to their rescue, or they'd be a stranger and they'd be like, well, why is there a stranger, you know, who's sick in our town? And they would, you know, do something about it. But in a huge city where it's, you know, there's this social science research that points to like kind of a number that we can have in our community, like a number of people. And I think it's a little bit over 100, but I can't remember the exact number, but that's the maximum number of people that we could have some kind of meaningful relationship. Like we could basically remember their name and their face and something significant about them, so that when we interact with them, we have that common basis. But if you try to include more people beyond that in your circle, you can't really have a significant relationship. So there's something special about that number, and it's been pretty well researched. Well, when you're in an urban environment, you're just interacting with way, way more people than you could possibly keep track of. And so you still have your tribe or your community, but it's not in geographically oriented, right? It's not like your neighbors or people who live in your immediate area. It's people who you know through various connections, like through family members or work, or, you know, you met them through social media or even in person, although I think that's more rare these days than it was. And then you pretty much, that's your community. And so it's someone, you know, 10 blocks up the road this way, someone a half hour away. And so that when you're out in your area, you're going to work or you're walking to the neighborhood store, none of those people are part of your community. They're all strangers. And many of them, you know, you wouldn't even recognize, like you really never seen before. And so can you realistically invest the resources to treat them as a human being when you already have a full community, right? And if you did that, like, would it overwhelm you that you would, every time, like, you pass by someone, you know, who needed help or who is struggling, would you have, if you stopped and helped them, right? Well, would that overwhelm you and you wouldn't be able to do anything else? So there are kind of these difficult social mechanisms at play that really change people's behaviors and makes it so that people, you know, basically put up a wall around them. And they might, you know, occasionally make eye contact by accident or have to, you know, say a polite, you know, sorry when they bump into someone too hard. But, you know, light contact is just expected. You know, it doesn't even require acknowledgement. And you just get desensitized to this thing about interacting with people in a personal way. And I think it makes you more alone, really, overall, even though you're surrounded by more people.
Which probably leads to the tribal mentality of going for your favorite sporting team or your political party. And I mean, I'm fortunate enough to live on a farm here. We've got 25 acres and we're in a community that people know each other's names, and you can call someone and say, hey, I've got a bad issue here. Can you bring your tractor over and help us out? And it's such a different reality. But walking around this neighborhood or this area, people are smiling when you see them. And I wonder if the future is going back to these smaller community type living arrangements, if that isn't part of our solution for long-term sustainable health, getting out of the cities, getting out of these sort of division where people are yelling at the TV screen for their favorite football team or baseball team, or yelling at the screen over the Democrat or the Republican in a debate.
I think that really is the mass group psychology was really talked about a lot by Edward Bernays, and even Freud talked a bit about mass psychology, and Bernays drew upon that material as a way to controls large groups of people like societies. Because when they become part of a group, and I think the big sports teams may even really be a part of this, because basically takes away the individuality, right? And it makes you feel stronger being part of that group, something to identify with. But, you know, that group is against another group, right? Because whoever, they're fans of the team in that city, right? But then in the other city, the people are fans of that team. So it puts those people against each other, right? Creating rivalries and competition and such instead of cooperation and collaboration. But, you know, I think what you're saying about how people, you know, why would they smile aside from just being happier, maybe living in a rural area, in a small community, you have to be accountable to the other members of the community because you do need them to come over with a tractor sometimes, right? And they need you to come over and, you know, cook for them, right? In your case. So that is like really useful. And if you, you know, snub your nose at those people, then, you know, you're on your way to being cast out of that community. Whereas in the big city, there's no accountability because who are you going to be accountable? There are different people there, you know, every hour of the day. But I do think people are moving, like I'm looking to go into a rural area and start or collaborate with some kind of homesteading community. Because, you know, one is, I think that's one of the only ways to stay out of the kind of control system that's getting more and more dictatorial. And also that kind of life, I think, is a better kind of life. You know, I think in addition to the urbanization, our modern culture has gotten us away from doing things for ourselves or knowing how to do things for ourselves, like grow our own food, for example, or, you know, make things, fix things. You know, it's like we're kind of like invalid children that we, you know, everyone has to do things for us or tell us what to do. So, you know, getting back to a natural setting, you know, out of the city and the suburbs into, you know, real nature with, you know, forest land on the property. And then, you know, learning how to do for yourself. Like I've been experimenting with growing some food this summer and, you know, I put very, very little attention and still I take food and put it in my kitchen and eat it. You know, and it's like, I'm sure that if I scale this up and was a little bit more attuned to it, it wouldn't be that hard to grow almost all my own food. So, you know, this kind of things, I think, really empower us and help us live more of the kind of life perhaps that we really are designed for.
Let's talk about empowerment then, because I think you hit the nail on the head. Well, I know you've hit the nail on the head. And when you see clients over the years or patients over the years, is there a sense of disempowerment? Is that one of the main, I guess, I don't want to call them flaws, but do you think that is one of the main reasons people come or are disconnected from that joy and happiness in their life? Is that disempowerment?
Yeah, absolutely. And this, you know, this really plays out in the healthcare system. So, you know, I have like two different opposing experiences as a psychiatrist versus as a natural healing consultant. So in the years that I practiced psychiatry, I mean, pretty much the people who came to me were of two sorts. One, they were brought there by someone else, right? Which could have been law enforcement or could have been a family member or a parent or a teacher, right? Who said that this person had a problem and you need to go get help from a psychiatrist or get fixed from a psychiatrist. And then there were the people who came of their, you know, own volition that they were just really suffering. So, you know, it's hard to talk about the people that were coerced there or forced there, but the people who came willingly essentially wanted someone to fix them, right? Someone to make their problems disappear. There was almost never when someone said, you know, what can I do to make my life better, right? It was always like, what pill can you give me that's going to make me not feel this bad? Right? Like escape, kind of magic potion. But most importantly, that it's sort of, it's not really their responsibility. And they, part of that comes from this dogma of that, you know, mental illness is caused by a chemical imbalance, which there's no scientific evidence for. But it comes from actually like the effect of a drug. Like they gave people a drug, they thought it helped. So they said, well, what does the drug do? And they said, oh, it does this. So this must be involved in mental illness. And that's really all the science there is to it. But if you believe that, right, then what can you do to correct the chemical imbalance? You know, I don't know how to do that. Do you? Right. So I got to go to someone with a white coat, or, you know, most psychiatrists don't wear white coats, but nonetheless, you know, someone with a diploma or the prescription pad. And so that's really how things work. And you end up trying to motivate the person to actually make some changes in their life, but it's always like resistance. Now, as a natural healing consultant, what happens is that I don't do anything. People come to me because they want to learn how to heal themselves. And I just am like a teacher. I give them information, and I don't always have all the answers, of course, but, and whatever, my information is not the only way to heal either. I want to make sure people know that there's not just one way for your body to heal successfully. But these people that come to me now, they're so motivated. Many times they've already done a whole bunch of things trying to heal themselves. They just didn't have quite the right knowledge or the right approach, and it wasn't working. And so they came to see if I could give them something different to try. But they do it all. They have to get the materials themselves. They have to plan out a schedule. They have to, you know, actually change what they eat. They have to do the cleansing. They have to take whatever supplements and other stuff. And if they don't do it, they're only accountable to themselves. Like, I'm not checking up on them. I just give them the information, and then it's up to them. And if they have more questions, they can come back to me for more information. But that's the way, like, these people are totally empowered, right? They already knew that. And that's why they sought me out, because they somehow, I'm not sure what affected them to be different from the standard model of most of what our society's like, but many of them did have a bad experience, or maybe they were injured by some kind of medical treatment and that helped them to see things differently. But they pretty much all know that, you know, whatever something they did, not intentionally, perhaps, caused their health problems. And it's up to them to do different things to allow their body to use its restorative healing power to get better. And that's, you know, what I think is really the future paradigm of health. And that's really what I want to do is help in my, you know, small part to try to bring that out, you know, to the post-pandemic world era.
The post-pandemic is, it does seem, I know you're outspoken about what's been going on for the last 7 or 8 months, and so have I, much to the detriment of my so-called reputation here in Australia. But I think it's gone on.
I just got a new Samir article about me just before this call, actually. So
lucky you. Congratulations.
Yes, thank you.
Take it as a compliment. I mean, where are we now? We're October, I think it's October the 1st for us here in Australia, or the 31st. It's late September.
That's right. You're in the future.
And I think we're so far beyond any concern over this pandemic now that it's, and no disrespect to anybody out there, but it's become somewhat comedic now that people are still talking about cases. And it's just, it's like, when is the joke going to finish? You know, the punchline. It's like when you've got one of those family members that like to tell a really, 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 really long joke and you won't get to the punchline, and then it's a shit joke anyway. I feel like this is what this pandemic is.
You know, it seems that the harshest joke is in Australia.
What was the catalyst for you to press send or press return or record something and put it out there? And did you have doubt when you did that? And when was that first?
Oh, yeah, I can tell you exactly.
The line in the sand.
Well, you know, I had been on this kind of path of discovering that the medicine that I was taught in medical school to practice was not working. And specifically, you know, it started out in psychiatry, and I started learning through my own experience and researching. And then I looked at the rest of medicine and found, you know, lots of inadequacies. And it just kind of got deeper and deeper. And I reached a point where I discovered natural healing from Kelly Brogan initially. And, you know, using her protocol with someone was the first time ever had a patient cured of anxiety in, you know, a couple of weeks is all it took. So it really opened me up. And as I, you know, started, I wanted to learn as much as I could in order to actually be able to consult with people on healing issues. And in that process, I realized I had enough knowledge that I could start speaking about this. And especially I wanted to be critical of certain aspects of the medical system. But I was really reluctant because I was still working, you know, as a mainstream psychiatrist and as an expert witness. And that's, you know, like an area that you have to be kind of especially careful about your reputation, because things will come up in the courtroom and then, you know, they won't consider you a credible witness. So I had that background and I kind of decided I have to phase out of this mainstream medicine because I can't, like, I tried my best to take people off harmful medicines and try to introduce other ways for people to heal, but the system really doesn't allow you to do it. And in fact, I could have got, you know, done it that way, get in a lot of trouble because, you know, it's like not what you're, it's not the standard of care. And you're supposed to only, you know, under your license, provide the standard of care. So I kind of knew that the end was near and I wanted to go out, you know, come out publicly and talk about these things. But, you know, so I knew it could really hurt my reputation. It could get me fired from a job. There could be a challenge on my license, all these kind of risks. And then also, like, I know there have been a lot of people in natural healing who have, you know, mysteriously died. And that there could be additional danger because it's a threat to this, you know, huge operation, right? The pharmaceutical industry and the healthcare industry, it makes up a huge portion of our economic system. And so I was, you know, hesitant about all these things. And I spent about a year really carefully considering it and doing some research and making preparations and thinking, what would I talk about first and these kind of things. And so I reached a point where I was ready and I, you know, there was a couple of friends who encouraged me, and it was just November of last year that I made the first video. And then I made a few videos early on my own about, you know, detoxification and nutrition and things, and was very new to it. And then, you know, a couple of months later is when the pandemic started and kind of started to change what I talked about, obviously, because, you know, it's such a crucial event in our lives. And, you know, even historically, it's going to be. So, of course, I had to investigate and talk about it. But it's very new to me, this thing. It hasn't been that long. And, you know, it's been a wild ride.
I really hope you enjoyed the first half of this podcast. If you'd like to listen to the rest, please visit evolvenetwork.tv. That's evolvenetwork.tv. We'll see you there.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.